I just need to make a couple of announcements, and one is, could Julia Juth go to the creche, please? Another thing I've been asked to say, and I appreciate how difficult this is, but there are many people here whose first language isn't English, and when children are crying, it's very hard to hear. So can I leave it to your discretion and your sensitivity to take your little one out if he or she is crying? Thank you very much. I have very great pleasure in introducing our next speaker, Dr. Anne Oakley, who is a medical sociologist and who's written extensively on women's subjects and who is currently researching social support for pregnant women. Dr. Anne?
Well, my brief for this slot in the program was that I should do the history of home birth in 15 minutes, bearing in mind the need not only to talk about Britain, but instead to take a totally international perspective. I think this is a bit of a tall order, so I'm going to keep the agenda as simple as possible and say what are perhaps some rather obvious things about the history of home birth. So if I appear to oversimplify, please forgive me. The question as to where the world's babies are and have been born is actually far from simple. Many competing interests shape both policy and practice relating to place of birth. The past and the present and the future of place of birth are different in different places. So bearing all this wonderfully confusing diversity in mind, where should we begin? First of all, I think an awful lot of nonsense is talked about home birth. Or perhaps I should say that an awful lot more nonsense is talked about hospital birth. Home birth is simply what normally happens. Over most of the world and throughout most of history, children have been born not in institutions but in families. That is because, on the whole, human beings live in families and not in institutions. Although I'm leaving aside here the question of whether the family is an institution that oppresses the people who live in it. Even today, the vast majority of babies are born at home, and the person who helps the mother give birth is, as you've already heard, not a doctor in a white coat, but a midwife who knows the mother and who lives in the same community as she does. And I'm talking here, of course, not only about the industrialized countries, but about the third world, which hasn't yet developed. In other words, it hasn't so far developed the same bad habits as we have. As a matter of fact, I think this is one of the most important contributions a conference such as this can make. It can highlight the need for other countries to avoid making the same mistakes as we have. Secondly, when people discuss the subject of place of birth, and by people I mean health professionals of various kinds, expectant parents, policymakers, everyone who has a stake in this issue, there is, I think, a tendency to become wonderfully unscientific. And by unscientific, I mean that facts are ignored and emotions take over. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with emotions. Indeed, the worst culprits here are probably the obstetricians, who often seem to get incredibly upset at the suggestion that routine hospital birth is not the safest policy. They allow themselves to be swayed by their own personal experience, and of course many of them have no experience of home birth. Those parents who have been involved in home birth can be swayed in the opposite direction and can sometimes go overboard in describing the glorious experience of giving birth to a baby at home. I speak as a mother who has had two children in hospital and one at home. My eldest child was born in hospital 21 years ago, and he is now training to be a mechanical engineer, and I have often wondered whether there is any connection between those two facts. Especially since his sister, born a year later, wants to be a writer and was an uneventful home birth, which I remember chiefly now for the wonderful comfort of being able to actually eat a meal cooked by my mother after the baby was born. However, all my theories about the relationship between place of birth and personality are disproven by the younger sister of these two, who was born in hospital 10 years ago, had a rather disturbed early few weeks, and is now one of the calmest and most sensible people I know. I think the point is that we do not need to prove that place of birth has a long-term effect on children's personality. We need to know what we want, we need to know what is safe, and we need to know how to bring about the necessary changes in the maternity services. Could I have the first slide, please? What? Which? Can I? Right. No, the one on before that. All right. Okay. Before I get on to the history of home birth, I want to say a word about the present. And the first thing I want to say is that I don't think there's any doubt that a hospital delivery rate of 99% counts as a mistake. I know the question of safety is going to be discussed later on, and I don't want to anticipate what's going to be said. But I would just like to draw your attention to these conclusions from the excellent review Rona Campbell carried out of this subject with Alison McFarlane. Firstly, the statistical association between increased hospital delivery and decreased perinatal mortality is unlikely to be cause and effect. Secondly, there is no evidence that the safest policy is for all women to give birth in hospital. Thirdly, morbidity is higher amongst mothers and babies cared for in an institutional setting. Fourthly, most women with experience of home and hospital delivery prefer home delivery. Those are facts. And so is this. This is a slide about freedom of choice. The slide actually shows part of an advertisement for a new type of obstetric bed, which allows a labouring woman to position herself in various ways. The problem is that whichever way she looks, the obstetrician is there in his Wellington boots and his hat and his mask. And whatever she does, that bed is in a hospital. Here we have some consequences of hospital maternity care, none of which obtain in a home birth. The first one is more hospital care. For example, a baby born in hospital is more likely to receive special neonatal care than one who isn't. A mother who has an instrumental delivery may be hospitalised for all her subsequent labours for this reason. The second consequence of hospital is more technology, since by being in hospital, technology is accessible to staff caring for the mother, which wouldn't be at home. And this is so even in hospital-based birth rooms, where the technology is cleverly concealed in a cupboard or behind a flowered curtain, from whence it can quickly be persuaded out to take over. Hospitals are also responsible for iatrogenic morbidity, and the very act of being in hospital is a form of institutionalisation. Now, we all know what institutions do to people. They deprive you of your identity, they make you feel just one case among many, and they certainly don't enable you to feel responsible for what's happening to you. Lastly, we have ritualisation, separation and depression, and I think the meaning of those terms is fairly obvious. Hospitals are full of rituals, the rituals of pre-delivery shaving and enemas, the new rituals of instant mother-baby bonding, the ritual of giving men a chair to sit on in the labour ward and hoping this will make them feel useful, the ritual of the 6 a.m. cup of tea and so on. Even in the best hospitals, mothers and babies are inevitably separated. Between 30 and 80% of women in industrialised countries get depressed after childbirth. And although there's no hard evidence to prove that hospitalisation causes this, much of what is embedded in women's accounts of postnatal depression suggests that it does. The next question is, how did we get from a situation in which home birth was the norm to one in which it is an exception to be negotiated only by assertive middle-class women who have done their homework and know what they want? She's not going to take it lying down. Now, to answer this question, I'm going to use Britain as a case study, although I will throw in one or two appalling references to North America for good measure. This slide shows the changing proportion of British babies delivered in hospital. The most rapid period of decline in home birth was in the 1960s. In the 16 years from 1946 to 62, there was a 12% rise in hospital delivery. But in the 8 years between 1962 and 1970, hospital delivery went up by 20%. Many other countries, with a few notable exceptions, such as Holland, experienced the same sort of changes. In 1936, the British Medical Association issued a manifesto on the maternity services, which was published in the British Medical Journal. And this document, which I'm going to quote from, contains many clues as to why home birth declined. In the year of the manifesto, 1936, two-thirds of British babies were born at home. There was no national health service, and maternal mortality was only just beginning to show its first decline for a century. The British Medical Association was very worried about public and professional responses to the outcry about maternal risks in childbirth. At that time, the risks that were concentrated on were those to the mother and not to the child. So the BMA said in its manifesto, it wanted to emphasize that the fact that maternity, this is a quote, maternity is a natural physiological event. Departures from the normal occur in a small proportion of cases, but the vast majority of cases are conducted with complete success in every respect. And the BMA went on to say that all available evidence demonstrates that normal confinements and those which show only minor departures from the normal can more safely be conducted at home than in hospital. In view of this, the association wanted to know why some women at that time appeared to want to have their babies in hospital. And it said that the greatest factor in the demand to be delivered in hospital is the campaign of publicity by which it is expected that maternal mortality will be reduced. The belief has grown up among women that they are less liable in hospital than at home to succumb to the death which they are told may await them. This carries with it a desire to have a doctor in case anything should go wrong, and also probably to avoid pain by having an anaesthetic. A second crucial question the BMA asked in its manifesto was why hospital maternity beds were expanding in numbers. And the answer it gave here was that the new doctors who were in charge of antenatal clinics had started to admit more and more women to hospital without careful selection of cases on medical grounds. And this was preventing the local general practitioners from experience of normal maternity care. And finally, the BMA went on to say that the increase in hospital delivery was actually causing deaths, because when a large number of maternity cases are aggregated in hospitals, there is an increased risk of infection. In other words, they got a lot of things right, I think, about the reasons why people were having more and more children at home. The first point that they make is that the declining rate in home births in Britain and other countries was never based on evidence of the benefits to mothers and babies which would accrue as a result of this shift in policy. And a second important point is that you really can't call it a question of policy at all. It was a situation that evolved, and no one planned it. In this country, this was recognised by a government report in 1970, which said that even without specific policy directive, the institutional confinement rate has risen from 65% in 1957 to 71% in 1968, and shows every sign of continuing to rise, so that discussion of the advantages and disadvantages of home or hospital confinement is in one sense academic. This report went on to advocate a hospital delivery rate of virtually 100%. And another reason why they said this was because the birth rate was falling and there were hospital beds to be filled. Thirdly, this document pointed out that there was and is important counter-evidence that the hospitalisation of normal births creates rather than solves problems. So given these factors, you might well ask, why did it happen? Why has home birth almost disappeared? I always get the feeling when looking at the history of home birth that I'm reading a rather bad detective story. There's no shortage of plots, and there's certainly no shortage of victims, but partly because of this, the criminal is never caught. It's quite impossible to pin him down. He's always got some excuse or other which lets him off the hook. But you can find in the documents of the period some important clues, as I said. And a lot of the clues have to do with a word of critical significance in the debate about what's happening to maternity care in the world today, and that word is control. Place of birth is one among many victims of the fight the obstetrical establishment has fought and won for control of childbirth. The problem is that so long as birth happened at home, obstetricians who wanted to call themselves the experts couldn't have any say in how it happened. So they had to get the women to go into hospital. And once they got them there, all kinds of wonderful things became possible. Active management of labour, for example, where the term active refers to the obstetrician, not the mother. The use of syntocinon to start and accelerate labour, for example, or continuous fetal heart rate monitoring in labour. Even a new epidemic to replace the old, that of caesarean section. Hospital-based obstetricians produced all sorts of rationales for intervention from the 1920s on. In the United States, the most famous early proponent of obstetric intervention was a Dr. Joseph DeLee of Chicago, who in 1920 argued for the routine use of forceps and episiotomy in all births. In DeLee's procedure, the woman would be sedated for the entire second stage of labour and the fetus would be forcibly removed from her body. DeLee saw the normal process of birth as itself pathological, hence the need for hospitalisation and intervention. He once said, and I'm quoting, "So frequent are these bad effects that I have often wondered whether nature did not deliberately intend women to be used up in the process of reproduction, in a manner analogous to that of the salmon, which dies after spawning." Conference of this kind is a wonderful occasion on which to produce sexist quotes. Coming back to Britain as a case study, it was no accident, I think, that in 1936, when the British Medical Association complained about the increasing hospitalisation of births, this year was also the year in which the College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists in Britain received its Royal Charter. In Britain, we have this funny habit of thinking that if you attach the word royal to something, it makes it better. The Royal College of Obstetricians had a habit of anticipating all the government reports on policy towards place of birth. Every time a government report advocated a particular percentage of babies to be born in hospital, the Royal College of Obstetricians had anticipated this by at least 10 years. So it was in 1944 that they first said 70% of babies should be born in hospital. And it was no accident that during the years of the fastest increase in hospital confinement, those were also the years in which there was the fastest increase in the proportion of consultant obstetricians. In other words, there's a relationship between the professionalisation of obstetrics and the move of birth into hospital. However, much earlier than this, doctors had begun to refer to the fact that in order to learn something about birth, doctors had to get women to go into hospital. In 1912, one doctor in Scotland made the observation, quote, "that we cannot teach nurses, midwives, or students without popular maternity hospitals well filled with normal cases." He went on to say that it is the duty of the medical profession to encourage women of the working classes to go to a maternity hospital for their confinement. The link between social disadvantage and medical experimentation has a long history, and pregnant women have by no means been exempt from the rule that the best subjects for research and experimentation are those who have least power. But the childbirth picture is complicated. For middle-class women by the 1920s and 30s, in places such as Britain and North America, did want to give birth in hospital, for one reason in particular, the availability of pain relief. In America especially, the movement for twilight sleep was spearheaded by women with feminist sympathies who wanted to use the new medical techniques to help rather than hinder women. So women's own decisions have played an important role in the move towards hospital birth, although they have clearly been encouraged by a barrage of medical misinformation. One of the problems is that for a very long time, even if you had a baby in hospital, you were quite likely to get away with a normal delivery. And it's really only since 1960 that you have run a much higher risk of intervention and technology in hospital. But the motif of women's choices about this has also been important for a long time. In 1960, when the Association for Improvements in the Maternity Services was formed, the argument was still being put by those defending a woman's right to choose that if she wanted to have a hospital birth, she should be able to have one. 20 years later, of course, the argument was the other way round, and a woman's right to choose had become the right to choose a home birth. To summarise, then, what happened to home birth is that over the last 50 years, a new breed of experts has become involved in childbirth, experts who call themselves obstetricians and who needed to establish a legitimate territory for themselves in the area of childbirth. This meant challenging the old breed of experts, the midwives, who were skilled in the art or science of managing normal childbirth. In defining childbirth as abnormal, which is the only thing the obstetricians could really think of doing in order to get their hands on it, they needed to get childbirth out of the hands of women and midwives and into the hospital so that they had a chance to interfere enough to make childbirth abnormal. There are those who could say this is a gross oversimplification, but I prefer to see it as the only interpretation which fits the facts. It's quite compatible, I think, with saying that there are some medical advances that are very important and there are some mothers and babies who do need the benefits of specialist hospital care. I want to end by making 4 points. Firstly, the move away from home birth and the decline in independent midwifery have gone hand in hand. It's difficult, if not impossible, for midwives to retain their professional autonomy in hospital settings. This matters because there is good evidence that most women and babies are better off when cared for by midwives than by obstetricians, and it matters, of course, to midwives too. So the debate about the future of home birth is at the same time a debate about the future of female midwifery, despite the fact that we do have one or two charismatic male experts around. I'm sure they would agree with what I've just said. Secondly, the problem cannot be solved by taking healthcare out of the public sector. Insofar as we are talking about choice and the right of women to determine where they give birth, then we are talking about the rights of all women, not just the privileged minority who can buy an individual solution for themselves. Thirdly, the problem of place of birth is partly a problem of women as a group. The trouble with women is that they won't do as they're told. This is one doctor in 1888. Wise women choose their doctors and trust them. This is the point that Sheila was making about trust. The wisest ask the fewest questions. The terrible patients are nervous women with long memories who question much where answers are difficult. The nervous woman should be made to comprehend at the outset that the physician means to have his way unhampered. And another one, 100 years later. Women like you always give us trouble. You are constantly interfering in matters you do not really understand. If only you would relax and let us get on with our job, there would be no problem. So although history is about change, it's also about continuity. Finally, the argument for high hospitalisation rates is an argument about the fact that it's risky to have a baby. I think home birth would never have disappeared had it not been for the concept of risk. But who says childbirth is risky, and how risky is it compared to the other hazards of everyday life? My last slide, which I hope you can read, is an amateurish attempt to put the risk of childbirth in perspective. It shows the risk of dying for various sorts of passengers on trains, in aeroplanes, in cars, on bicycles, and lastly, for the mother and baby in the act of reproduction. The most dangerous thing of all is riding a bicycle, whether of the motorized or unmotorized kind. So if those who formulate policy in the maternity services really want to improve the health of the nation, perhaps they should concentrate on getting rid of bicycles instead of home births. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Anne. I have pleasure in introducing our next speaker now, who is mother, grandmother, psychic, healer, journey person, and may I welcome Carol Elliott.
Speaking at this conference is a bit like being born. You sit down there in the dark and your heart starts to beat, and suddenly you're out here in the light and people are looking at you. It's very nerve-wracking. Birth is a fact of life. No matter what our race, our culture, our religion, our sex, our belief systems, the one experience common to all of us is birth and death. Whether we believe in an individual soul energy continuing through countless incarnations, or one earthly existence with an afterlife and the hereafter, or a collective unconscious linking us, or a belief that we exist only in the material world and death is final, the one experience common to us all that we remember consciously or unconsciously is birth. And that memory is stored in our cells, affecting our personality, our ability to cope in times of stress, our deepest feelings about ourselves and the world around us. Inquiries into the life of the unborn child show that the development of a sense of a personal self and the beginnings of personality begin inside the womb. It is even possible that there is consciousness at conception and prior to conception, that we choose to incarnate at a particular time to our particular parents and in this particular body for a reason, to realize a life purpose that affects us on deep and profound spiritual and psychic levels. From my own experiences personally and from my work with others, I believe this to be true. However and whatever, it does seem that there are precise and highly individualistic learnings taking place inside the womb. The circumstances of our conception, the relationship between our parents, what was happening for our mother during the pregnancy, and the birth experience itself all influence our psyche and our personality. I wonder if you'd be willing to share an experience with me which may show us some insights into our own process. So if you could make sure that you're sitting comfortably with your back straight and both feet on the floor. Feels better that way anyway. And now close your eyes and focus your awareness on your breath. Breathe slowly and deeply into your belly and let yourself relax as much as possible. Let all your muscles relax. Every cell, every tissue can relax. Your arms, your legs, all relaxing and continuing to relax. Relax your forehead, the little muscles around the eyes, and relax the eyeballs themselves so they seem to turn inwards and downwards. Relax the eyebrows so that they seem to move ever so gently away from each other, allowing a feeling of spaciousness and openness between the brows. Relax the jaw muscles so that as the jaw muscles relax, so the tongue falls to the base of the mouth, allow yourself to relax, to feel so heavy that you could sink right through your chair. And at the same time, you're so light, as if you were floating in space, weightless, without gravity. And then, like an autumn leaf, effortlessly sinking down, down, spiraling down, until you settle ever so gently on Mother Earth beneath. One, deeper and deeper. Two, more and more relaxed. Three, four, five. Imagine now you are in the womb, a baby, totally immersed in water, warm water kept at a constant temperature, and every movement felt through water. It is dark. You can feel the boundaries of the womb, the warm, silky, smooth placenta constantly nurturing you. Feel the pulse of the cord linking you to that placenta. Feel the energy pulsing at your navel. You're receiving food and energy through the cord. Perhaps you hold it sometimes or curl around it, do acrobatics with it. Her voice, familiar but distant, heard underwater, and an incredibly sensitive telepathic link with your mother's thoughts and feelings. You move, you sleep, you dream. But now it is time to leave the womb. Perhaps it's become cramped and constricted. And so you initiate the process that is a transition between your warm, dark, watery world and life outside the womb. Together, you and your mother work to bring you forth. The uterus contracts around you and squeezes you, pushing your head down onto the cervix, which gradually opens, allowing you to descend down the birth canal and out into another world. Was this a world full of love and joy and calmness? Did you experience that cycle in which you left your dark, watery world to be returned in an instant to your mother's arms? The feel of her skin, her warmth, her smell, her sounds of welcome, that precious eye contact that bonds forever. Was your cord left to pulsate for extra security while you establish lung breathing? Did you learn that you are safe out there in the outside world? Did you learn that you can take journeys into the unknown with the confidence that comes from trust, from knowing deep down that you're okay, that things will turn out right, that you are loved and wanted and welcomed? Or were you born into coldness, harsh lights, loud sounds, panic, fear, handled roughly, abruptly separated from your mother and your placenta? Was your mother unconscious or drugged, not really there for you? Are your deepest feelings that people hurt you, that it's not safe to trust, that you feel cut off or separate, that you can't get what you want or need? Many of us have negative thoughts and feelings about ourselves that we repeat over and over in our lives. Thoughts like we're not good enough or strong enough, that we can't do it on our own, that we can't get enough, and so on. If, like me, you had a negative birth experience, and many of us working in the field of birth are trying to heal our own birth traumas, take a moment now to go inside yourself and forgive all those who treated you roughly and insensitively through ignorance at your birth. Let go of old patterns connected with that early life, and allow those early patterns to become what they really are, just history. Reaffirm yourself as a strong, vital, alive, intelligent, and loving human being. And then take a deep breath, and if your eyes are still closed, open them. Recently, I was midwife for an English woman living in Bali. It was a beautiful birth at home. The woman on her knees, she had her elbows on the hammock in which she had spent much of her pregnancy. She was rocking backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, all through the labor, backwards and forwards, silent and peaceful. It was a big room with rattan blinds curled up, and outside there were tropical gardens, the family temple, and beyond the Agung, a mountain sacred to the Balinese. Then a tropical sunrise came up and lit the room and the laboring woman, and soon the baby's head crowned, and he was born into an atmosphere of peacefulness and joy. Two Balinese women who worked there appeared exactly at the moment prior to birth, unbidden, but tuned in to the powerful birth energy. They clapped their hands at the instant of birth to dispel any lurking demons, rather to my surprise, and then they told later how amazed they were at such a quick and easy birth. Apparently, they now give birth in the progressive, desirable Western way. That is, going to the local hospital and lying on their backs with their legs in stirrups. They have been forced to abandon their bidans, Balinese for traditional midwife, and many of their traditional birth practices in order to be modern like us. How sad, and such a travesty for a people who so respect the God in children that they never put them down on the ground until they are 6 months old. One of the most precious gifts we can offer our children is birth at home, where it is safe, familiar, warm, and loving, where birth is a natural process, not an illness, where babies can be welcomed into calmness and love. Home is where a woman becoming a mother can be free to experience this powerful process in her own environment, in her own way, and in her own time. Free to go into her deepest self, surrendering to the primal energy coursing through her, a journey to find hidden strengths and powers, to be at one with her child and with the potential of her own self-transformation. Home is where a man as father can support the woman in this process, gain an insight into the miracle of birth, and bond with the new being he helped to create. Happy, positive birth experiences contribute to the physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being of ourselves, our children, and indeed of this planet, which is home to us all. Birth belongs to the home and the hearth, to the center of the family. Home is where the heart is. And to finish, I'd like to show you a few moments of a birth at home in Australia 10 years ago. I was the midwife, and the song you hear in the background was written and sung by the father, and all the musicians were friends of the family.
Oh, mother, you're beyond the beyond. Make it the billion years old, right? You've got to get usually to speak.
She's not much turnip. She's really Australian.
Yeah, you can be so. We're born together, we've got a baby brother.
We love babies.
Captain, what do you think your little baby brother?
You can really feel it opening like a flower, you know, daring to experience things. The cord only stops pulsing when it's really ready to it. Nothing abrupt, nothing jarring.
You just have to know that the more you relax, the easier and faster it is for your child to come into the world. Certainly helped to have
you to clean up your bed and make everything.
So many loving people and really it's totally essential to have a father with you. I just couldn't have made it without that constant close power and energy. Just really need it. You feel like you're drawing it off the people. Don't you?
There is a load of love and energy to give
you the strength to ride over the top of it.
You were fantastic. Coming through the mother with all senses completely open and full of the purity that we don't seem to have later in our lives. It's such a precious and special moment. And when a baby comes out into love and joy and calm and peacefulness and not a hustle bustle or an anxious feeling, but really just comes out in quiet and onto the mother's belly, so it's hearing the heart that it heard inside. And just the massage of the mother's hands on the back and this gentle feeling.
Thank you very much, Carol, and a brutal return to North London. Before our interval, a couple of announcements. One of our speakers has sold her notes attached to one of the programs. If anyone bought a program with some notes written on it, including which our panelists, the parents' panel, could they very kindly return them to me here in the as soon as they can? I hide a note of desperation in my voice. Could the parents also meet Joanna in the green room, as she asked, as soon as possible, please? Another announcement, the people who are sitting in block 4, which is the block over there, the first one going up, I'm very sorry, but that has in fact been reserved for people with the headsets for simultaneous translation. So I'm afraid the ushers are going to very gently usher you out of those seats, unless you already have headsets. And the people who did book them should move to those ones there where they can hear the translation. I hope that doesn't cause too much inconvenience. We're opening up the seats along the sides here for people who find they've got short of a seat. So apologies, but if we could rearrange that when you come back after the break. Could mothers also, with their babies, their children in the creche, pay a visit to their children during the interval, as the creche people would like that? And the final thing is,
As you rush out, go to the Hampton Room, which is on the ground floor for your refreshments, rather than the Champion and Entertainment bars on the first floor, because you're likely to get served a lot quicker there, and as you know, we're getting a little pressed for time. So, Hampton Room on the ground floor, parents to crash, headset people to move, and can we reconvene here at 12 noon, please?